If you've ever wondered why Amazing Grace is the national anthem of funerals, or pondered the state of your eternal soul after you die, the Lutheran Witness has you covered. Check out the June and July issue of the Lutheran Witness to learn more about death, dying, heaven, and hell. Not a subscriber? Visit cph.org/trylutheranwitness for a special offer of $6.99 for 6 digital or print issues. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. The Washington Post column from their perspective section with the headline, Islamophobes want to recreate the Crusades, but they don't understand them at all. They weren't a clash of civilizations or a war of Christianity against Islam. When you hear the word crusade, what do you think of? It's a term that has fallen out of favor in politics since, well, probably the era of George W. Bush, who inadvisedly used the term when talking about some military action in the Middle East. So what were they? How do we rightly understand them? And were the Crusaders of the medieval era, were they Islamophobes in the modern sense of the term? Joining us to talk about this column in the Washington Post, Dr. Matt Phillips, Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd. It's great to be back.
What was your general reaction to the Washington Post column on Islamophobes and the Crusades?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I know Matt Gabriel. I would consider him a congenial colleague and hopefully a friend, even if we don't always agree on everything. He wrote a really good book on the legacy of Charlemagne. And I actually agree with some of the things he said in this article, so we can talk about that. But I just want to say that up front, that so people would know that who are listening.
So what are the parts, what are the elements of his column on Islamophobia and the Crusades that you agree with?
I would say, you know, I don't really like the term Islamophobia. I don't like most of the phobia terms because I think they're catch-all phrases that you use to go after your opponents, but that's fine. Political opponents and social opponents. But if we just take it from the point of view of people who just inherently hate all Muslims, quote, and there probably are some people like that, yeah, you can abuse history. I don't think we need to recreate the Crusades to deal with radical Islamic terror. I do think radical Islamic terror is a big problem, and I think it's in some ways, this is my personal view, in some ways inherent to Islam and Islam's foundations. Having said that, I do not think that all Muslims necessarily abide by that. And I like to think even a majority of the Muslims in the world don't abide necessarily by, you know, something as radical as you know, what ISIS or Al-Qaeda or those groups promote. So,
Do you think that the average person who has probably what would amount to maybe a junior high level,
right,
if that, understanding of history in general, understands in any sense the Crusades?
Probably not. In some ways, I think Matt's, or I'll call him Dr. Gabriel. Dr. Gabriel's column in some ways points that out in the sense that there's a lot of ignorance about what the medieval period was and what the Middle Ages were and what the Crusades were specifically. So do you want me to give some examples?
Absolutely.
Okay, all right. This is radio, right? I would say, you know, a lot of people used to say, and this used to be in textbooks, you know, the reason why the Crusades started was to colonize the Middle. It was the first colonial Western colonization of the Near East. And he doesn't mention that in this. Maybe it just didn't relate to what he was talking about. But that's been completely blown out of the water by all modern scholarship. Starting, if you really want to look at the greats, is Jonathan Riley Smith. He's a name that people should look at. My advisor at St. Louis University, Thomas Madden, who you've interviewed in the past. So, and that's been totally blown out of the water. It still appears in some textbooks, unfortunately, the idea that it was a colonization, in the sense that it was a proto-colonization similar to the 19th and early 20th century colonizations. So that's one myth. Another myth would be that the Crusaders really didn't have any religious inspiration, that the only thing they really wanted was money and land and such, and that there was no religion really involved. Religion was just a veneer for something else. And I think most people have rejected that. So those are probably the two biggest ones I can think of. Maybe I'll think of some other stuff as we talk. So
let's go back and do a little kind of Crusades 101 and talk about what they really were. First of all, that term Islamophobia, I know that it's not useful in really in any way, but as it's generally used today in our context, could we accuse the Crusaders or those who supported them over this long period of time, could we accuse them of Islamophobia?
I mean, we'd accuse them of a whole lot of things by our modern standards or postmodern standards. So in one sense, I would say yes, and in another sense, I would say no. By the standards of their time and the beliefs that they held, they believed they were fighting someone who was the aggressor, and that they were actually defending, at the beginning, Eastern Christians who called for their help, explicitly called for their help, and then later defending territories that that should have been part of the Christian world in their minds and should never have been conquered by the Islamic conquest going back many centuries. It's a yes and a no in that sense. Does that make sense the way I explained that?
Well, what Islamophobia generally means nowadays is that it's another term for racism. It's kind of a subclass of racism.
Oh, no. This is one thing that really bothers me is the idea that if you criticize Islam or criticize the actions of some Muslims, you are somehow a racist, and that's ridiculous. Islam, like Christianity, is not a racially based religion. Although it started out among Arabs, Islam is a universal religion in the sense that it wants everyone to join and believes all people have souls, and so it's similar to Christianity in that sense that there's no one race-based group that follows it. So that's a miss. To try to equate anybody's criticism of Islam in general or Islam certain actions of Muslims or specific Muslims as, quote, racism is, frankly, a red herring. I think it would be a red herring.
So
it's factually incorrect. Now, does that mean that some people who criticize some Muslims aren't doing it based on racial animus? I can't tell you that. I mean, I can't speak for every specific individual. I'm sure there are some like that.
What do we need to understand about the nexus of what we would call today culture or politics and religion in both Christendom of the time and in the world of Islam at the time in order to understand the clash that we call the Crusades?
Well, no one had the very modern concept, post-Enlightenment concept of separation of church and state, or the post-Enlightenment concept of general religious tolerance among individuals in society. No one at that time, I mean, there might have been one outlier, but almost no one that was Muslim, Christian, perhaps even Jewish at the time, would have held to some type of idea that we believe in what modern or postmodern people think of as religious tolerance or pluralism or what some call multiculturalism. The idea that we can all have different religious beliefs and live in the same society and get along with each other was a foreign notion to those people. Somebody had to be the dominant group. Now, that didn't mean there weren't different religious groups living around each other, but in predominantly Muslim places, the Muslims were the rulers. And Jews and Christians were second-class demas to them. And that's what Islam taught from the very beginning. And that is still the case in places like Saudi Arabia and specific Muslim countries. Not all of them, but specific Muslim countries still follow that position. So
the notion that a kingdom or an empire would be coterminous with Christianity, maybe not. In Christianity in its entirety, but that it would be considered a Christian thing was not unusual.
Right. Oh, and absolutely not. What we call the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Christians that was centered in Constantinople were explicitly that. The idea that the Pope was calling these warriors then to go as a religious duty to go help fight in the Crusades was centered in religious belief. So you cannot understand the Middle Ages nor the Crusades without understanding their religious belief on both sides.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, just a little primer on the Crusades. We have the general lay of the land. How did they begin? How did they proceed? And how did they end? Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest, Associate Professor of History at Concordia University in Nebraska. We're talking about a Washington Post column titled, Islamophobes Want to Recreate the Crusades, but they don't understand them at all. Stay tuned.
the church's music from the 20th century. The 17th century. The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's Word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all.
The Consortium for Classical Lutheran Education invites you to attend our Reformation Summer Conference, July 11 through 13, 2017, in Cheyenne, Wyoming, focused on truth and education. Speakers include the Reverend Rolf Preuss, Dr. Angus Manouge, and Dr. Thomas Korchak. Enjoy this year's unique banquet experience at a Wyoming bison ranch. Visit ccle.org for more speakers and information. At ccle.org.
Your pastor has been called to shepherd you as a member of Christ's flock. Doxology offers an innovative program of advanced study retreats where your pastor can be refreshed, renewed, and refocused. Find out more at doxology.us. Many pastors report that doxology has been one of the most valuable learning experiences since seminary. Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. Doxology.us. Doxology.us.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about a Washington Post column titled, Islamophobes Want to Recreate the Crusades, but they don't understand them at all. Dr. Matt Phillips of Concordia University, Nebraska, is our guest. We'll still make room for you at the 5th Annual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference tomorrow and Saturday right here in Collinsville, Illinois. You can meet and hear Matt Harrison, Chris Roseborough, Terry Mattingly, Aaron Wolf, Peter Bender, Todd Peppercorn, Jonathan Fisk, and Will Whedon. If you'd like to attend both days, the registration fee is $80. That doesn't include the meal plan. Saturday, if that's all you're coming for, is $60. And again, in either case, we can't provide the meal plan for those discounted prices. Register tonight at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 9th and Saturday, June 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. Matt, let's just give the briefest of histories of these things called the Crusades. First of all, we're talking about a rather long period of time.
Remember, we did a series on it, so yeah.
and very diverse activities, too. But how did they begin?
And I will say, Dr. Gabriel does recognize that in his column. So he does talk about the new that there was complex and so forth. And that's one thing I would agree with him about, is that he's saying there are some people, generally people on the right of the political spectrum, that are simplifying things. One of the criticisms that I and others that I know who are Crusades scholars say that he's doing the same thing on the other side. that he seems to do what on the other side of that. But let me talk about the First Crusade. And this is actually where the biggest historiographical, I won't say mistake, but disagreement that I would have with Dr. Gabriel's work, in that he downplays the threat of Islam at the end of the 11th century and says things like, oh, well, they had forgotten about Jerusalem being lost in the 7th century, you know, and their Islam, you know, had kind of, they were getting along well in some ways. Everybody kind of recognized the border layouts now, and it wasn't any big deal. Jonathan Rowley Smith would disagree with that. I believe Tom Madden, I don't want to speak for them, but based on what I learned from them, would not agree with that basic notion. Specifically, the Turks, the Seljuk Turks, who converted to Islam and came into the Middle East and began attacking the Byzantine Empire, were a great threat. It is true that the Turks and other Muslims were fighting each other at that time. There's truth to that, and a lot of the Westerners didn't understand all that, too. But you know what? Aren't Muslims, different Muslim groups, fighting each other today? You know, some of that is similar. Not the same, but it's got a similarity. So there was a big threat in the Western Christian's mind, and definitely in the Eastern Christian's mind. Now, we could argue about how real that threat was, but to them there was a huge threat, and they saw what became known as the First Crusade as a defensive war. There's no doubt about it. Does that mean they always did... they always did Christian things in war and so forth? No, they were warriors who did some bad stuff sometimes, probably some very bad things. So I think that's the biggest historiographical argument that I and others who have kind of talked to through email and stuff about the article, primarily, that we disagree with. And that's fine. That's kind of an inter-crusade historian's debate. And that's what academics do. They debate things. But on the other hand, it is an important part of the argument that he's trying to make. So taking that part of the argument out, I think, does change the rest, some of the other things he says. I do also agree with him, though, that the 19th and early 20th century Europeans had a very bad understanding of the Crusades and used it as a nationalistic tool, particularly in the Middle East. And that's true. And I think he's right on with that. That actually gives us some of the problems we have today, of the interventionism that's been going on in the Middle East from Westerners, British and French first, in the late 19th and early 20th century, and equating that to Crusades, or making it similar to the Crusades. This is why Osama bin Laden and then others will call Westerners, quote, Crusaders. When I don't think most Western soldiers see themselves as Crusaders, although there are circumstances, and I think he rightly points out some people using that imagery. And I would say to those people, stop it. Don't use that imagery. You're not on a crusade. So in that sense, I would agree with him. So I hope I'm giving a kind of a balanced view of where I agree and disagree with him.
The Crusades begin at the threat that is being sensed by the Western Church, not only to itself indirectly, but directly to the Eastern Church.
Talk correct. In the late 11th century, starting in the mid-11th century, the Turks come pouring into the Middle East. Most of them become Muslims, and they start attacking. Sometimes they fought each other. Sometimes they fought other Muslims. But they began attacking the Eastern Christian Empire in what today would be modern Turkey. And they began winning. They kill an emperor in 1071. So they began basically further conquering land in what today would be Eastern Turkey and all across what today is Turkey, going towards Constantinople, which is modern-day Istanbul. So to say that there was not a direct Muslim threat at that moment, and they did so in the name of Islam, okay? They weren't just, they were Islamic warriors. They saw themselves that way. That doesn't mean they didn't want other stuff too, just like Christians, you know, they do things for religion and for other reasons. But they were attacking the Byzantine Empire, and essentially the Byzantine Empire had been at war with some, off and on, some form of Islam since Islam's inception, since the Arab conquest that began, the Islamic conquest led by Arabs that began in the 7th century. I mean, much of what became the Islamic Empire was all Byzantine Christian territory. North Africa, what today would be Israel, Syria, Turkey, the whole area, that whole area of what's called the Levant would have all been part of the Byzantine Empire. And there were Christians that live under Islamic rule. There still are Christians living in some of those places under Islamic rule. So to say that it was not a threat, or that Christians, you know, just kind of used this as a reason for some other nefarious reasons, I believe it's just wrong. I just disagree with that. I hope I'm not saying too much of what he meant, but I'm just going by what I read in the article. So,
how did the Crusades come to an end? Did they just simply fizzle out, or is there a point where you could say historically this is where they stopped?
Another great question that is still debated somewhat. And, you know, there are four or five different views among scholars about what Crusades were, you know. And he talks a little bit about the term Crusade. The term Crusade comes from the word that means one signed by the cross. Basically, Crusaders were called pilgrims because they were armed pilgrims. Before that, you'll see them called pilgrims in the sources. The Crusades... there are different times you can point to. Some people would say there were Crusades all the way up to the 17th century because there were still papal indulgences being given to people to fight Muslim attackers or other attackers. So if you define the Crusade broadly as the idea that anyone fighting for a holy cause and receiving an indulgence for it, then you could define the Crusades up to about early 17th century. However, I think most medievalists... they kind of study the main period of the Crusades would be about 1095 to about 1300. There were definitely Crusades after that. There's a whole book about that called The Later Crusades. So I'm not saying there's not, but those are probably the main periods of the era that most people think of as the big crusading era are the 12th and 13th centuries.
So if there's one thing, with about a minute here, Matt, yep. One thing that people need to know when they pick up a column like the one in the Washington Post that makes mention of the Crusades, what is the one piece of information that the average person needs to know about that?
Well, I don't
that
know if there's just one. One that, as he fairly somewhat points out, that the Crusades is a complex issue, and there are a lot of issues behind it. The other thing they need to realize is professors are people. I'm a person. He's a person. I have plenty of friends with diverse views about life and politics and religion today. And that their personal views go into these, right? They can't keep those out necessarily. And I think he definitely hints at that in much of his work. Not much of his work is scholarly work, but I mean in this work here. I mean, Matt Gabriel is active online. He's a active scholar, which I applaud him for in that extent. But he's not afraid to share his personal political views or social views about things. I would like to point out there is a response to Dr. Gabriel's column that was published by a friend of mine on his personal educational blog, and his name is Andrew Holt. If you look up Andrew Holt, PhD, and Crusades, you'll find the response to that. And I think it's a very good response, a historiographical response to Dr. Gabriel's column. I also know there is a submitted, I can't tell you who has submitted it, but there is a submitted response that someone sent to the Washington Post to ask a scholar who is asking to respond in the Washington Post to Dr. Gabriel's column. And I don't know, at this point, I don't know if that's been accepted or not. And I can't tell you the person's name yet either because I would want them to cover that themselves. I hope they do submit that because I think it would be good for people to see how scholars can debate each other and do so without acrimony.
Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. We will link to the response that he mentioned there before at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Matt, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks, y'all. Have a good day.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll be broadcasting live from the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. You can come out and join us for that live broadcast. We'll be talking with Pastor Jonathan Fisk about raising Christian children in an age of progressivism. And we'll visit with Dr. Matt Richard, author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? This is a survey of 12 false Christs. And sometimes by looking at the counterfeit, you get a better idea of what the real article really is. That's what this book is all about. Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the book, Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
People are talking about the Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Lutheran FCU was created solely to serve LCMS workers, families, and entities, and proceeds benefit LCMS organizations. Lutheran FCU offers deposit accounts and loans and has service access at thousands of branches and ATMs nationwide. Lutheran FCU also offers members Christian-based lending advice for new loans and refinancing, minimal account fees, and superior personalized service. Check them out at LutheranFCU.org.